Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
Coming up, seeing the fire damage here at Flag Fen with our own eyes.
Checking in on the project to rebuild an Anglo-Saxon ship.
And the Bayer tapestries coming home, sort of.
It's all here on the Time Team podcast.
Yes, hello and welcome to the Time Team podcast and welcome to Flag Fen. It very much feels like we're in the middle of a bog or something, but we are here at Flag Fen and we are really, really pleased to call it home for this episode. My name is Martin Williams, this is Dr. Helen Geek, and this is the Time Team podcast where we're doing all the usual stuff as well, so you can expect Time Team news a little bit later on, and Helen's going to be answering your questions as well.
Now, this is a really unique place. It was discovered by Time Team's Francis Pryor in the 1980s, and it's the site of a Bronze Age causeway which ran out into the Fens being this boggy area all around us.
And not only is it a great place for archaeology, it's a great place for learning as well. It's the school holidays at the moment, the summer school holidays, and the children, you can see them running around this site, learning all sorts of things and going in and out of the reconstructed roundhouses. And that is where we start, because as you might remember, we brought you news on a previous edition of the podcast of a fire at one of the roundhouses that's been reconstructed here at Flag Fen. We were talking to Francis Pryor about it on a previous episode. Well, whilst we were here, Helen has been to see that damage for herself.
I've seen lots of pictures of the damage, but it's not until you actually see it in person that you get the shock of what's actually happened here. There's just so much damage over such a large area, and you get an idea of what it must have looked like when it was all so beautiful and standing there and ready to receive school groups and so on. Now, I've got Kirsty, one of the heritage teachers here, to ask you all the details. I mean, it must have been tremendously upsetting when you realised it was on fire.
Yes, it was indeed. It's a real heartbreaking loss for us here at Flag Fen. Yeah. And it's not just a roundhouse, it's what it represented for us. Sense of community. Community coming together to build the roundhouse, but also that special space where we could gather with groups of school children. And we welcome over 10,000 children every academic year here.
Yeah, it's so many. And it wasn't at the end of its life by any means, was it? I mean, it all looks quite, the bits that are unburnt look pretty fresh. How old was the house?
It was about 3 years old, so relatively new in the story of the life of a roundhouse. But yes, it's very sad to see. But the aim is to build back, and that's what we do at Flag Fen. We pick up and we carry on.
Absolutely. And you've got an extra little thing that wouldn't otherwise happen, because you've got to excavate it first, haven't you? And that's a whole different ball game to experimental archaeology and reconstruction archaeology.
This is a wealth of information here now that we can find out about the patterns of the burning and so on. And I can imagine that fires like this would have happened back in the Bronze Age, back in prehistory, and it's a rich source of information for us now.
There's so much that you can see that's different about how the fire happened in different places, with this daub here that's almost like a kind of ceramic, almost like a kind of fired earth, and then you go round and it's a lot muddier, and then there's all the straw that didn't even get burnt there. I suppose we're going to be able to use this in lots of really creative ways.
Oh, absolutely. And when we have visitors here, particularly the school children, we're keen to get them involved in hands-on experimental archaeology. And the roundhouse is a fantastic living example of that. And actually there's some interesting tales to do with this roundhouse. So our brilliant volunteers and staff who worked on this particular building will say there's areas of the daub they didn't get it quite right, and it was lumpy and bumpy, and then the appearance of it improved as they went around.
Oh, so you could actually point to bits of it and say this bit's worse, this bit's better, this bit's more accurate, this bit's maybe less accurate. It was like, yes, a living teaching aid.
Yes, it was. Yes, indeed. And the children quite like that, yeah, that you don't get everything right the first time you attempt it. So it was a great learning opportunity, and this building will continue to tell stories for us.
That is just fantastic, isn't it? So out of the tragedy of the loss of this as a communal space, at least you have got those things. I can see you're already fizzing with ideas of, yes, how to use it in the future. Well, thank you so much, Kirsty. It's been wonderful and inspirational talking to you.
Thank you very much.
Now, earlier this year, Time Team archaeologists were back at Sutton Hoo. We were excavating, weren't we, just a stone's throw from the world-famous burial mounds as our dig there entered its second year.
Yes, and the mounds are famous partly because of what was buried inside at least two of them. Huge Anglo-Saxon wooden ships held together with thousands of iron rivets. But how did they get there? Were they dragged by hundreds of people up the steep slopes from the river to the top of the Hoo? And what would it have been like to be on one of these vessels as it was rowed in and out of its harbour?
Yeah, it's exciting to think about, isn't it? But rather than speculate, a group of volunteers is finding an answer, doing it themselves. They're building an exact replica of the ship using traditional techniques, and we've been following their story ever since it started.
Yes, and Jack Barnard from the Sutton Hoo Ships Company is with us now, sitting in the middle of the ship, it seems.
Hi, Jack.
Hi, hello. Yeah, here I am, sitting where the water would be if we were out in the high seas, probably getting very, very wet. So you would normally sit quite this far down in the hull, but it feels really great to actually be inside the ship at last.
Yes, and it is rising up around you very, very quickly, isn't it, now? And how is progress? Where are we at with the ship?
Yeah, no, it's been great. We've had a real rush on. All of a sudden, loads of planking has gone on. If you can remember, we were really struggling for some of the wider planking. When we got over that problem, we were able to put lots and lots of planking on. So the ship, which is nine strakes or nine rows of planking on either side, is almost at eight rows of planking on either side now. So it really does feel like a ship at last, which is great.
Oh, that's brilliant. Now, a little birdie tells me that you've been in Denmark recently with something to do with the work that you're doing. So can you explain what you've been doing in Denmark?
Yeah, certainly. More than just something to do. So we went out there on a research trip. So myself and Laurie Walker, the master shipwright, we spent a long time looking at different sites in Denmark and Germany, at ships that had come before and after this one. And then later on in the week, we went over to Roskilde, where the Viking ships are. So they've got at least 30 different vessels, and they're constantly building Viking ships. So we were able to sort of compare and contrast the technologies and how they built these. We were able to sort of spend a lot of time with the shipwrights and the people rowing the ships to see how they handled. And got loads and loads of insights, which is really, really going to help us.
And what did you learn about the rowing? Because I'm really keen to know what you learnt in terms of who would be able to row this. Now, I know, Jack, you're very small and slight, but incredibly strong. And you took with you Andy, didn't you, who's over 6 foot tall, so he's like at the other extreme. But what I'm hoping is that I'm somewhere in the middle. Will I possibly be able to row the ship?
Absolutely. So when we went to Roskilde and we looked at Gokstad, it was incredible how close the rowers were. So Helen, you'd struggle. I'd be better off because I'm shorter. So when I leaned forward, I wouldn't be ramming the person in front quite so much and getting quite so much in the kidneys. But on there, the people are so close together, and we lined ourselves up in that formation and tried to sort of do this in formation. And it just shows that even on a ship like this, we're going to have to train people to be absolutely in formation with one another, or we're going to start going like this and getting in each other's way.
Yes, yes, absolutely. So this is one of those occasions where it actually works better to be smaller. I mean, Martin, you might struggle more than me.
I'm not going to have a hope.
Well, I mean, one of the things that they did, which sounded quite funny, and we need to mock this up, is they use a piece of rope in a circle around your shoulders and onto your hands, and that limits the amount that you can stretch forward and back. So if you could imagine I was here and I'd got this piece of rope around me, that would be my training I could never go further forward than that or further back because I've only got this rope width. And you'd all be given the same. So a taller person would be held back more than a shorter person who might have to reach out. So again, you know, we've got lots of things, lots of models that we want to make, lots of things that we want to test. So we need to see what that's like. But the spacing in this ship is nothing like as intense as it is in that ship. So, you know, we've got a little bit more space to play with. I think one of the things that's slightly different about this ship is our spacing isn't exactly even all the way down. So we've got these beautiful frames that you can see I'm sitting on one here. They're not, I don't think they're exactly evenly spaced all the way down. And we curve up at either end. So the rowers are going to be higher and lower.
So, Jack, with all this research, obviously the work is very much still going on around you. So are we any closer to a completion date? Do we dare whisper when this might be finished?
I can whisper it quite loudly, so I can actually tell you that we have got a whole crew that are now organising the launch, and we're aiming for approximately the last day of May in 2027. So just as big as the whole project of building the ship is, the launching is going to be equally as large an event, really. So we're well on the way, and we think the ship will pretty much be finished by the end of 2026, but it will give us enough time, you know, to tinker with it, get people trained up, because even the launching of it, we're going to have to train people and walk them through. So we've got some, you know, we're looking at every possibility at the moment. We've got some kind of interesting and novel, quaint ideas, really. So we just have to work through our modern health and safety to see whether or not those things are possible. But yes, we are definitely looking to, you know, spring 2027.
Oh, well, Jack, we're with you every step of the way, and we're looking forward to catching up with you again very soon. By the way, if you are interested in learning a little bit more about what the Sutton Hoo Ships Company have been up to, then we do have an exclusive video tour for our Time Team members, don't we? So you can go and support us on Patreon to see Meg Russell getting a bit of a tour of the Longshed in Woodbridge.
You might have heard the exciting news about the Bear Tapestry recently. All 68.3 metres of it, that's 224 feet, is coming to the UK, which is incredibly exciting. Now, we're doing a swap with the Bear Museum in France. We're getting the Bear Tapestry for a bit, and they're getting some of the material from Sutton Hoo Mound 1, including the iconic helmet, which, of course, we on Time Team are very familiar with.
We are very familiar. I mean, this is great news for people in this country because it means far more people will actually be able to see the tapestry. So if you are planning to go to have a little look, what should you be looking out for? Well, Dr. Alexandra Makin is a specialist in early medieval embroidery. Great to have you on, Alex. Hello.
Hello, thank you for asking me.
That is a pleasure. How then do you feel about the tapestry coming to the UK?
When it was first announced back in 2018, I was, like everybody else, I think, really, really excited about the whole thing. But then obviously nothing happened for various reasons. So when the announcement was made this time, I'm a little bit more cautious about it because obviously it will be really exciting if it happens. But we've got to make sure, well, the conservators in France have got to make sure that it's okay to travel. So fingers crossed. And as the time draws near and everything's confirmed, then you'll see me getting more excited about it.
Do we know if it was actually made in England?
So we have strong evidence to suggest that it was made in England. A lot of research and scholars have pointed out that the design and the imagery is similar to surviving manuscripts that were at St. Augustine's monastery in Canterbury. So we have that strong link through the design side. But then from the embroidery side, embroiderers from early medieval England were renowned throughout what is now Europe. And we have the beautiful surviving embroideries sort of on the Cuthbert vestments, the stola maniple, etc. But we also have documentary sources that talk about women embroidering hangings with depicting the deeds of their husband. And they were hanging these embroideries in their homes. So we have lots of different types of evidence to suggest that it was made in what's now England, combined with the fact that while there is some documentary evidence that embroidery was being produced in Normandy by women of a higher rank, the skill set wasn't spread through society as it is what was in early medieval England.
So then at what point did it make its way over to Bayeux?
This is a question. It's a bit of a mystery. I love mysteries in research. So the first hardcore evidence, if you would like, is a documentary source from the 15th century that talks about the Bayeux tapestry being in Bayeux Cathedral, and it's put on display once a year for a few days over the feast of Saint John, if I remember correctly, and then it's packed away again at the end, and then it's brought out on this occasion annually. So this is the kind of evidence that we've got for its first appearing in Bayeux. But whether it was there before that, well, this is a tradition that's set by that point, so it must have arrived before that date. We just don't know.
It does seem extraordinary that it was rolled up and put away and brought out again so many times by Bayeux Cathedral in the past. And obviously you can't just roll it up and bring it over to England. I mean, it's going to be so difficult to get it here. And it's extraordinary that it's survived at all. I mean, how significant and rare is it?
So today it's very rare because it is the, as far as we're aware at the moment, obviously, it's the only surviving hanging that tells you this story that you can read, that isn't just a fragment, an archaeological fragment. It's, you know, it survives to such an extent that we can read this, the story that it's telling us. But at the time, it was a wall hanging. There were lots of them. It's made of wool and linen. It wasn't made of precious silk or gold or other types of metal threads and things like that. And so people would haul it out of its storage and hang it up and then put it back again, like you read in Beowulf, where they decorated the hall in honour of Beowulf. It's only from from antiquarians through to today where we feel very precious about it, and understandably so.
Do you have a favourite bit, Alex, of the tapestry?
That's a horrible question to ask. No, I don't. I have lots of bits that I like a lot. If I had to pick one area, it would be the seams that join the panels of ground fabric together. So I was really lucky in the fact that I was given permission to look at photographs of the reverse of the tapestry. These were taken in the 1981 to 1982 conservation programme. I was able to study around the seams and demonstrate that actually each panel was embroidered separately. They were then joined together and the embroidery was worked over the top of the seams. And then from that, I was able to tell lots of new stories and things about how the tapestry was created. So that's really cool. And I think those would be one of the many areas that I like.
Brilliant. And what are you hoping then with the tapestry coming to the UK, you as a researcher will be able to do? Because I just think, what more could we possibly learn from it? You know, we've studied this thing
Yeah, I know a lot of people ask that, but there's so much more that we could learn from it from a technical point of view. So, for example, from a stitching perspective, because obviously I've only been able to look at small sections of the hanging. I think to look at all of it would be a lifetime's work. But then there's also things like investigating the fibres themselves. It's that technical side that I'm really interested in, and I hope that we'll be able to learn a lot more about that. We researchers are hoping that we'll get an opportunity to study it in more detail.
It does seem like such a great opportunity. Thank you so much, Alex. It's really whetted my appetite to go and see it as soon as it arrives. And thank you so much for coming on the podcast. It's been really lovely having you.
Thank you.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
This is the Time Team podcast with Dr. Helen Geek and Martin Williams here at Flag Fen. Now, Helen is going to be out and about very, very shortly. But first, there's lots and lots going on in the world of archaeology. So with the latest edition of Time Team News, here's Danny Wooden.
Thanks, Martin. No, with the scorching weather that we're having this summer, imagine what it must have been like for Roman soldiers in sweltering conditions in Egypt around 2,000 years ago. After being in a storage box for 114 years, an extremely rare Roman military sun hat has been brought back to life and put on display at Bolton Museum in northern Britain. The woolen felt hat was originally donated by famous Egyptologist Flinders Petrie. However, it was too fragile to go on display due to damage caused by pests and other environmental conditions. So it was laid flat in a box and put into storage, where it remained for over a century. Expert conservator Jackie Hyman has restored the hat to its original shape using hand-dyed fabric where the missing fragments were. The wide brim is reminiscent of the famous ancient Greek petessus hat, which was worn by Greek farmers and travellers, and even the god Hermes, who's frequently depicted wearing a petessus in ancient art. The restoration was kindly funded by local firm Ritherdon & Co, and the hat's now on display at the entrance to Bolton Museum's Egypt Galleries. Now, from the blazing sun of Egypt to another country known for its extreme heat, Australia. A recent article published in the journal Australian Archaeology highlights a project that's mapping finger marks thought to be thousands of years old in the deepest, darkest depths of a cave far beyond sunlight. The location is the New Guinea 2 cave, also known as Warrybrook 2, Gunai Kunai Elders. The project involves a team of international archaeologists and Gunai Kunai Land and Waters Aboriginal Corporation. Together, they've identified around 950 long grooves in the cave, which is indicative of people tracing their fingers over the soft limestone walls and leaving an impression in the surface. These finger marks have been intricately mapped using high-resolution photogrammetry, and the researchers have noticed that the marks only occur in particular sections of the cave, and these sections are where you get white calcite microcrystals that sparkle like glitter when exposed to firelight or torchlight. There are no signs of domestic occupation, such as hearths or food remains at the site, and this ties in with oral traditions that caves like Warrybrook were only accessed by Mulamalung, or medicine men and women, who collected microcrystals to use as part of their spiritual practice. In the paper, the researchers suggest that what we're looking at are the hand movements and gestures of the Mulamalung as they access the powers that they associated with sparkling crystals thousands of years ago. Now, from intense sunlight and cool caves to the shimmering sea, well, at least ships that sailed on the sea anyway, and to the excavation of an historic shipyard in the New Forest in southern Britain. A team led by Southampton University and funded by Bucklershard Shipyard Trust have excavated the largest of five surviving historic slipways at Bucklershard, where ships were built and launched. During the 1700s, it was the largest shipbuilding yard of its time, and it built 55 wooden warships for the Royal Navy, including HMS Agamemnon, Lord Nelson's favourite ship, which took part in the Battle of Trafalgar. Professor John Adams from the University of Southampton, who led the team, noted that most 18th century slipways are no longer accessible, so this slipway provides a unique opportunity to understand and learn more about traditional shipbuilding. Well, that's all from me. I look forward to seeing you next time.
Thanks, Danny. We're here at Flag Fen, which has featured quite a bit in recent episodes of the podcast, because we've been talking about the damage caused when one of the reconstructed roundhouses was burnt down. And we've had Francis Pryor, who's been telling us about the silver lining that the accident gives us, that we can find out more about how a genuine roundhouse would have appeared once it had been burnt down. Now, I thought I ought to come here and see it for myself, and we've got a couple of volunteers lined up to talk to. I'm going to go into the roundhouse and find Sharon now. Hi, Sharon. Now, you've been a volunteer here for how long?
Since October, November, saw an advert in the local paper asking for volunteers to come and build a new roundhouse. So I came along on the open day, had a look round, signed all the paperwork, and I've been here ever since. I came on a Monday and a Friday for 3 hours, just volunteering, helping to build the roundhouse. Never done anything like this before in my life. I'm retired. So I thought, yeah, that'd be quite good, interesting. We're a good group, we have a good laugh, and it's really enjoying, I'm really enjoying it.
I'm really impressed that you started off in those hard winter months, because it must have been absolutely freezing, and you get quite wet and dirty being a volunteer on something like this, particularly with the daub. Tell me about the daub.
Yeah, the daub is very interesting. It's a mixture of soil that we have to sieve, and then we have to collect the sheep droppings, mm-hmm. and then we have to mix it with water by hand, which is quite interesting, and then we literally place it on the wattle, and hopefully it stays as it is, like you can see now, and then at the end of it we have to paint it.
Well, thank you so much, Sharon. That's been a really interesting vignette into the life of a volunteer. I'm going to go and find, is it Arthur now,
yes,
who's
Arthur.
Doing some of the thatching. I'll
okay,
see you later.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Right, well, so that's the walls. Now, for more detail on the thatch, I'm going to try and find Arthur. Arthur? Oh, hello, hello. Good to meet you. I'm Helen. Hello.
So
you are, as we go, thatching this, and yep. You're deep in the straw. Is it straw? No, you're deep in the reeds.
Yep, so this stuff's actually Norfolk reed. And it's because that's what we naturally have an abundance of around in this part of the country. You might use thatching straw if you lived in a different part of the country where you have a bit more farmland. But if you have a sort of look around the place, you'll see they sort of pop up like weeds around here. So.
So are you bundling it and then tying the bundles on?
Yeah, so the first thing we need to do is we make these smaller bundles called yelms. And these are just sort of the right sort of size for us to stick up there. And you sort of, when you're making yelms, you need to get a bit of a happy medium because these are different lengths and they also taper to a point. If you make it too large, it's just going to come across at an angle and slip out. Oh. But if you make it too small, you'll just be here all day making them. Yeah.
And you don't bother to take the tops off. I mean, it all looks very frondy here, and I suppose that'll be covered by the next layer.
Yeah, so you don't really want to take the tops off of these. If you do look at the top of here, you can see it's actually hollow.
Yeah.
So if I take this, if I take the tops off, it means the moisture's going to get into there, and it just makes it last not quite as long.
Oh, so it's all these little nuances that you learn by doing it.
Yeah. I mean, you can also ask a lot of thatchers, but it depends on how much you want to believe them. According to some thatchers, with Norfolk reed, if you keep the fire going, the smoke going through it, Norfolk reed is supposed to last you about 100 years.
And so are we going to have... So you're on the first layer at the moment.
If we just make sure we don't trip over our string here, you can sort of see as we go along, we just build up in layers. And... specifically here you can see the string here where I've tied it on.
Yeah.
This one, the next layer above it, is always going to cover that layer below it. So this stuff is actually not open to the environment.
Yes.
It's going to last a lot long. But technically this would be the second layer, because on the very first layer you want to build it doubly thick, just because when the rain comes it's going to wash all the way down to this bottom layer. So
yeah.
This one needs to take the most amount of water.
So how long before you're right up to the top?
Oh, it's hard to say. We are sort of aiming to see if we can get it done by the end of the month, but that is going to depend on us. Generally, we only have you can only have about 2 people here, so
yeah.
We have people making yelms when we can do, and that helps speed things up.
Well, that seems really fast to me.
Yeah. Well, the good thing about it being a round structure is you're essentially dealing with a large cone. So the more you go up, the smaller an area you have to thatch.
Yeah.
So that does help quite a bit.
Yeah. Oh, well, thank you very much for showing me around it. It's very pretty as well as being very impressive.
Yep,
thanks.
No problem.
It's lovely to meet volunteers who are working on this building, learning new skills and creating something amazing that's going to be used for children and for all kinds of visitors for years and years to come.
Thank you so much, by the way, if you are supporting Time Team by being a Time Team member. There's so many ways that you can do that. Maybe it's just by clicking subscribe on this YouTube video. Maybe you're joining us on Patreon. And if you are there, by the way, you will know that we have a whole community where you get to ask your question to Helen. Come on in. Come on back in, Helen, because Hiya. The work begins now, because this is where you answer the questions that people, Time Team members on Patreon, have been getting in touch with. Let's hear the first one, and this one comes from Fiona in Seattle.
Hi, Helen. On Little Boy Blue, you were talking about the concept of edges and how it was an important archaeological concept, but I don't know what edges are. Could you explain? Thank you.
Well, that's actually quite a difficult thing to explain. I should have thought about that before I started talking about edges, because there's something that everybody always knows when you start digging. People say, well, just follow the edge down. But you don't always think about what an edge actually is. And this, for me, dates back to a conversation that I had with Mick, actually, on the Isle of Wight, when I had only just recently joined Time Team. And we were trying to distinguish post holes and features. We were trying to work out what was a feature and what wasn't. And we came back to this concept of the edge. I said, well, look, Mick, we know that this in the middle here is different to that 3 feet away. But where does it change? Where is the edge? And you can negotiate kind of where one kind of material is and another kind of material is and collaborate and decide on an edge. That's why it's often so helpful to stand up from your troweling, to look at what you're doing, to go and get a colleague and say, where do you think the edge is? So that's in soil. It's the edge in soil that starts off being important. But then you begin to find the concept of edges everywhere. And you're thinking, well, where's the edge of the Bronze Age? Where does it shade into the Iron Age? So we know that, say, life in 1300 BC is very different to life in 800 BC. Can we nudge up to a boundary, to an edge, and then be confident of it? Or in a typology, where is the edge between one type of say, brooch or pin and another type of brooch and pin? Well, I suppose in a way, it's a difficult concept because you're concentrating on the hard bits. The edges are the hard bits, the difficult bits. But it's so important, that concept of the edge, the getting into something different, something that changes. Why is it changing? Where is it changing? So that's my concept of the edge.
And can you sort of talk about stepping back and getting that bigger picture? That's yeah. where things like standing up on a big scaffolding or the drone photography kind of can come into play with spotting patterns and spotting different things.
Yeah, that's absolutely terribly important. If you're down on your knees staring too hard at it, or if you're looking at 810 BC as opposed to 820 BC, yes, that's no good. You've got to get the big view and you've got to be able to see the wood for the trees.
That's it. There we go. Mm. There you go, Fiona. I hope that's a good answer to the question for you. Let's have another one and let's go to Brian in London.
Hi, Helen and Martin. Very much enjoy the podcasts and the amazing reinvention of Time Team in the new format. And of course, a proud Patreon member. My question for the podcast is, what are the benefits and difficulties of patron-led episodes of the programme compared to when the programme was undertaken for TV? Thank you.
Well, that's a really interesting question. And I think I'd say to begin with that we do get an extra layer of freedom. We don't have the Channel 4 commissioning editors telling us what to do and deciding when they're going to show it. I mean, it was nice to have it predictable as Sunday evenings in the winter, but it was also very restrictive. So we couldn't show it to everybody all around the world at the same time. So now we're on YouTube, we can show it to everybody so people in America don't complain that they haven't seen that episode that we're talking
about. Heaven forbid.
Yeah. And also we can do much more. It's not just the 3 days and the documentaries. We can do a day here and a day there. We can pick up all sorts of interesting extra news that we couldn't do before. We do, of course, still have to pitch for money. I mean, we used to have to pitch for money to Channel 4, and we still have to pitch to everybody who funds us. So it's no worse, but maybe it's no better in a way. I mean, I think what's different is that we know that we're all part of the money-raising team. So we're encouraged to wear all the merchandise, as you can see. Now, that has a very odd thing, an odd consequence that you might not have thought of. It's, if you're a bit short-sighted like I am, you can come out of the dome and you're looking for somebody and everybody is wearing the same colours, everybody's wearing the same clothes. You can't see the people. You can't see Mick in his stripy jumper. You can't see Phil in his hat. You think, oh, I need to find this person, and you can't. It's just a sea of navy blue.
Okay, we need names on the backs of things. I mean,
like
something
footballers,
like that.
Yep. Absolutely, yes. And plus, occasionally, I feel that we're a bit, with that freedom, we're maybe a little bit too scattergun in our approach, because I really love those 3 days where we're all together as a team, we're all pushing forward to do a big piece of work. And we perhaps don't do as many of them as I'd like. And one of the reasons for that is that I mean, it's back to money again. One 3-dayer is almost as expensive as a whole month at Sutton Hoo, because they're enormous operations and they take a huge amount of planning, a huge amount of research and getting permissions and making sure everybody's on board and booking the experts and so on. So we have to start doing those way in advance when we're not even quite sure what we're going to be filming at that point. So the scheduling of getting everything together, who's going to be doing what in October, could we do it towards the beginning of February, or will it be too cold, you know, all that kind of stuff. It's all on our plates now with fewer people. So there's advantages and there are disadvantages. I'll tell you one other advantage, actually. You know, the very first series of Time Team had at the end of every programme, there was a kind of community roundup. Everybody was called back in from the local area.
Oh, yeah.
And Mick gave them an update. The whole team did. And that was really dear to Mick and Tim's heart.
Yeah.
And Channel 4 hated it. They got rid of it. It just wasn't fashionable in the 1990s. But now we can have community. We can have volunteers. We just can do so much more.
Yeah, and getting the community involved is a big part of what we like to do and what we do at Time Team. So there's positives and negatives, isn't there, to each of the different ways of doing it. Thank you very much for that question. Much appreciated. Thank you for all the questions. If you want to submit yours, well, why not join us? Become a member. Become a Time Team member and join us. If you go to Patreon, that is how you'll be able to ask a question. If you just click on community chats, you'll see that the section there for asking a question for a future edition of the podcast.
And that's about it from us here at Flagfen. Next week, it's another question and answer session. So if you're not doing so already, make sure you're listening in wherever you get your podcasts. Just search for Time Team.
Do that. Thank you very much. Got some great questions, by the way, including some Hadrian's Wall myth debunking. Ooh. That's going to be going on. And, well, we'll see what else. You'll have to make sure you're listening. Thank you so much, I should say, to all the staff here, the wonderful, really friendly and welcoming staff here at Flagfen. It's been absolutely wonderful. We will see you again on another edition of the Time Team podcast.
Goodbye.
Luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.